From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. George Balanchine wrote many ballets for dancer Suzanne Farrell. She says through choreographing ballets, he choreographed their lives. On today's Fresh Air, one of the great dancers of the century remembers her relationship on and off stage with one of the great choreographers of the century. Also today, 16 Tons has just been reissued, and who could resist the chance to talk to Tennessee Ernie Ford about it? Not me. Rock historian Ed Ward looks back at the long tradition of close harmony in country music, and we have a reading from poet Sharon Olds. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. With 13 foreign ministers in attendance, the UN Security Council has voted overwhelmingly to impose an air blockade against Iraq. Linda Fasulo reports from the UN.
The Security Council voted by 14-1 to impose an air embargo against Baghdad. Only Cuba voted against the measure. After casting his vote, Secretary of State James Baker called the meeting extraordinary. The action bars aircraft from flying to and from Iraq and occupied Kuwait without first having its cargo inspected for embargoed goods. Only medical supplies and food authorized by the Council for humanitarian purposes are permissible cargo, but enforcement is limited to peaceful means. The measure also calls for the detention of Iraqi merchant ships throughout the world and reminds the international community to freeze Iraqi assets. Finally, nations are warned that the Council is prepared to take action against countries that violate the embargo. For National Public Radio, I'm Linda Fasulo reporting at the UN.
Americans are getting first glimpses of Iraqi President Saddam Hussein's video message to the United States. Cable News Network began broadcasting portions of the 75-minute tape this afternoon. In it, Saddam said that President Bush was sending Americans to a war more terrible than Vietnam. Much of the message was devoted to a justification of Iraq's claim to Kuwait and charges that Kuwait and the Gulf states were involved in a conspiracy to impoverish his country and steal its oil. Saddam spoke in Arabic. His remarks were translated with English subtitles provided by Iraqi authorities. The Israeli army resumed demolishing 18 houses and stores along a road in the Gaza Strip refugee camp where an Israeli reservist was murdered last week. The Israeli Supreme Court has ruled the demolitions are legal. Linda Gradstein has more from Jerusalem.
Israeli bulldozers have already resumed tearing down 18 houses and shops near the entrance of the Gaza Strip Berej refugee camp. Yesterday, the army demolished 15 structures before the Supreme Court issued a temporary restraining order. But today, the court overturned that order after army officials argued that the demolitions were only to widen the road and not as punishment. They said widening the road will make it much easier for the army to preserve order in the camp and in the entire Gaza Strip. The army said the owners will receive financial compensation, but Palestinians charged the demolitions are collective punishment and retaliation for the murder of the Israeli reserve sergeant. Also today, two other Gaza refugee camps were placed under curfew to prevent unrest. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Stock prices bounced back today on Wall Street after falling to a 14-month low yesterday. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 33 points to close at 2,485.64 in moderate trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Suzanne Farrell, began dancing with the New York City Ballet more than 20 years ago. When she retired last year, critic Lord Schwartz described her as the most beloved dancer of his generation, and probably the greatest dancer George Balanchine ever worked with. Balanchine co-founded the New York City Ballet and became one of the century's most original choreographers. He was Farrell's mentor and for several years was her closest companion. She writes about their relationship on and off stage in her new memoir, Holding On to the Air. Farrell was known for her ability to dance with the speed and musicality demanded by Balanchine's difficult ballets. I asked her what she thinks were her new contributions, the contributions she made during her years with the New York City Ballet.
I don't know. I think perhaps the fact that I was not interested in looking the same or capitalizing on a certain particular success that I had had in the past. I was not afraid of falling down and being human and making mistakes. And in fact, that's your laboratory. That's where everything happened, was in the studio. And he was very patient and demanding in the sense that he wanted you to do more so that you could become more what you were really like.
You said you weren't afraid of falling down. You even tell a story in your book about how dancing in Paris, your first move you fell. You were on the floor just after the curtain opened.
Yes, well, I think it proved that I was not about to not be spontaneous and take a risk, even though I was in front of an audience who was unfalmiar with me.
Balanchine had told you, particularly for one dance, that he wanted you to dance off balance. This was for Don Quixote. What did that mean to you, dancing off balance, and is that something that you think you maintained long after that?
At the time, I really didn't know what he wanted because I was just trying to dance. And, of course, most dancers like to be well-placed, and you strive for perfection, and when you don't do what you want, it's always a little embarrassing. But I guess it was part of my childhood. I was a tomboy and didn't mind taking risks and was always in trouble somehow. So I guess part of that was my nature. And when he saw me be off balance and then recuperate and recover quickly, he liked that, found it interesting. And so in him pointing it out to me, it made me realize it. And eventually we took it even further than that.
You were one of the first ballet dancers to dance with your hair down. How did that come about?
Well, I was young, and I happened to have very long hair, and I think he liked that, and he thought it brought out a femininity, and for the particular ballets that he wanted to do at that time, I guess it was a new look. And also, when I have my hair down, I move differently. It sometimes can act as a veil, or makes me feel more feminine. Sometimes it has its problems also, but it's a quite a different feeling. And I feel more vulnerable when my hair is down.
Suzanne Farrell is my guest, and she's written a new memoir called Holding On to the Air. You had an extraordinary relationship with George Balanchine. When did you first realize that he was singling you out, that he thought that you were a very special dancer and a very special person?
The first ballet he did for me, Meditation, was done in 1963, and I was 18, and he was 59 at the time. And, of course, I was very flattered and shocked that he had noticed me so much and was interested in doing something. Of course, it's every dancer's dream to have his attention and his love, but then you have to be responsible for what happens, and I had no idea that it would develop into what it did. Of course, there were ballets in between, and I guess it was Don Quixote that really started the intense friendship and affection we had for each other. And it was a ballet that he had wanted to do all his life. He had said that he didn't do it because he was searching for the right person, and he found it in me, and that's a very big honor, and we became close, so close to the point that we didn't know what was on stage, off stage, and things grew in many ways, and grew backwards in many ways, and ultimately was pretty difficult. I nearly destroyed me at one time. On the other hand, dancing was our common bond. It was what we both had to do to be happy, and it's what brought us together. And we used to joke. I joked with him that if I weren't a dancer, he wouldn't even look at me. And he joked back and said, well, if I weren't a choreographer, you wouldn't look at me. So we took a long look at each other and started laughing. But no matter how intense things became, I always went back to dancing. We always worked together. It was a sanity and a salvation at the time of great stress.
Let's get back to 1963, when Balanchine was choreographing a dance for you and Jacques d'Amboise, and he wrote a love poem. Balanchine wrote a love poem and sent it to you and wrote, this is how Jacques should feel when he's dancing with you. And there was a P.S. in this note, and it said, I hope by now you are thin and beautiful and light to lift. Let's start with the love letter part, because it was pretty obvious to you that this was a love letter to you, although he said it was meant to describe what Jacques d'Amboise should be feeling. Did you know how to take it then?
No, not really. So because I was so confused, I just took it at face value as a poem about how our abstract characters were supposed to feel towards each other. That did help in some ways. I had never been in love before, so it was hard for me to know how I would have to dance this ballet. But I guess it all came out in the choreography. And in a way, he choreographed our lives with the format of the ballet, a young girl appearing to an older man and dancing even more passionately as it goes on, and then her disappearing again. It was a very poignant ballet.
You think it was about his feelings for you?
Yes, absolutely. Even to the point where he eventually had Jacques put gray in his hair.
How did you respond to the P.S. of this love poem? The P.S. was, I hope by now you are thin and beautiful and light to lift.
Well, after reading such a beautiful poem, it was certainly a letdown to read it, to find out that was how he saw me. On the other hand, I suppose he knew more about me than I did at the time, and I was had these sort of baby fat cheeks from playing the clarinet when I was 18, and had to lose that. But I felt terrible that I was not yet what he wanted me to be, so I had to start working on it.
And how did you work on making your cheeks thinner?
I would draw in my cheeks and also try to lose weight. Eventually, it did come off.
One of the things Balanchine has been criticized for was trying to create ballerinas who were so thin that they had to be anorexic in order to stay at the weight that he wanted. Do you think that was a fair criticism?
Absolutely not. No, he never wanted that. He was a man who liked variety in his dancers, not only in the way they danced, but also in the physical way they looked. And if you go to the New York City Ballet, especially in those days, there were tall, voluptuous girls, there were short, thin girls, there were medium-height girls. Some of the ballets were even characterized as tall girl ballets or short girl ballets. He had roles that he loved women, and he spent his whole life celebrating women and putting them on a pedestal, and he always had different visions of them in his ballets. The Siren in Prodigal Son, she was very voluptuous and seductive, and certainly all the characters I played in Don Quixote were different, and never was there a man who wanted more diverse women to do ballets for than him.
It must have been a very difficult situation in a way when you were in your early 20s, in love with a man in his early 60s who was married, who was also your teacher. And I think when you're like 40 years younger than somebody and they're a master at what they do and they're your teacher, it would be virtually impossible to feel like an equal in the personal relationship. And I'm wondering what effect that had on you.
Well, it was emotionally difficult, but as any performer, any artist will tell you, they're all looking for someone for this type of collaboration. Actresses nowadays don't have anyone writing plays for them. Composers aren't writing operas for singers. This is, you know, practically the only time in this period in the theater where one man was doing all these ballets for one person. It was quite a unique opportunity and something that every performing artist looks for. And you can't make it happen. I think it's chemistry. I think it's fate. I think it's being there at the right time. It's a lot of things that you don't have any control over. And yet it's wonderful when it happens. And the pain, I think, is part of that process. And ultimately, it's worth it in the end.
I'm thinking of the insecurity that must come out, too. There's this great security, probably, in knowing that someone cares for you so much and is writing things, choreographing things, especially for you. And on the other hand, I just keep thinking about the personal part of being younger, less experienced.
Well, I think the fact that I was younger and I was clumsy in how I handled it. Mm-hmm. Not that an older person would have been able to handle those kind of motions any easier. Mm-hmm. That's why maintaining my standard of dancing was so important to me, because if I lost that, then I really would have lost everything. And that was our real understanding, was our work.
Were you ever unsure what Balanchine wanted from the relationship with you?
No, I think ultimately he needed to choreograph to be happy to live. He would not talk about himself in terms of being a genius. He believed that God put him here, and this is what he was meant to do, and it would not occur to him not to do it. So I think he was very honest and clear that he was meant to work, and he needed inspiration.
So you felt that you were his muse in a lot of ways?
He said that, yes.
Which
is a pretty perilous place to be, especially when when as a young girl you want to work with this man and you want to be everything that he wants in a dancer, and then when suddenly you find that that is what he wants, it's sort of a dream that you're unprepared to live with as a human being.
Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Suzanne Farrell, who is considered one of the world's great ballerinas. She danced with the New York City Ballet for 18 years. Retired from dancing in 1989, and is now teaching. She's written a new memoir called Holding On to the Air. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Ballerina Suzanne Farrell is my guest. You were in the position of reading in the Chicago Sun-Times that Balanchine had said that you were engaged, and you knew nothing about this. Did you want to marry?
I wanted to dance at that particular time. I don't know. I don't really know what I wanted at that time. I don't even know if he did. It all got so confusing.
I want to ask you about something an incident that you describe in your memoir, Holding On to the Air. You said that there was a period when Balanchine had been very depressed, and someone in the company had said to you, what's wrong? And you confessed that you weren't going out together. So this person suggested that you start seeing him again. And then a prominent male dancer in the company said to you, why don't you just sleep with him? It doesn't have to mean anything. Is it such a big deal? What was your reaction to that?
I was, of course, shocked. That was just not the way I could live my life. And also, he was married. And I believe our relationship was very much on a spiritual level. He was a very spiritual man. He had to be. You can look at his ballets and see that he felt that he was in service to a higher ideal and to God. And that complicated matters. He, of course, was married.
You ended up getting married to somebody else, to someone who was also a dancer, who was a couple of years younger than you. What were the repercussions when you were married? And I should say that Balanchine had gotten a divorce just 2 weeks before that.
Well, this was a difficult period. I felt that if I continued dancing as well as I could, and that he was still happy with my dancing, that eventually things would all iron out and become good again, because I always wanted to be there for him and to be the dancer that he wanted me to be. But eventually, and quite understandably now when we look back, he didn't want to have Paul in the company anymore and started taking ballets away from him, and It became clear that things were not going to get any better. And actually, I'm convinced that it was necessary to leave the company. The only way we ever were to have survived was to separate.
So you and your husband were basically exiled from the company. You were around 23, I think, when you left.
Yes.
And you say that you were afraid other companies weren't hiring you. Other companies weren't hiring you, and you say that you think one of the reasons why was that they didn't want to alienate Balanchine because they had Balanchine dances in their repertoire and they wanted more. Do you think that Balanchine would have punished them by withholding new dances had one of these companies hired you as a dancer?
I don't really know, but emotions were very high at the time, and no one was acting very noble or sensibly, and it's a possibility. On the other hand, it was after you've had the New York City Ballet and Balanchine, which to me always was and always will be the best place to dance, whether I was a member of the company or not, I never changed my belief in him. It was really best to go to Europe and not stay in America. There was just, everything else was just not as good as I had, and it was time to move on.
How did you get back to the New York City Ballet?
We had been vacationing in upstate New York. We had purchased an island. Strangely enough, after we left the company, it was the most bizarre thing to do because we didn't have a future job in sight, didn't have any money, and things were not looking very good for us at the time in terms of finance and future. But we happened to visit that area, and an island was for sale, and I guess we felt that we just had to have roots somewhere, so we bought it. So then what happened was that we immediately moved to Europe, so we never got there. But during the summers, we would go and visit, and it's only about 2 hours from Saratoga Springs, where the company, New York City Ballet, would have its summer home and were performing. And I was eager to see what had been happening, what new ballets Balanchine had come up with, and to see some of my friends and to sort of just go back to where I had spent my summers in the past as a member of the New York City Ballet. So we went to a performance, and I saw a beautiful ballet, La Valse, which I had done many times before I left the company. And when I got back home, I was so happy to see such good dancing and to see such a beautiful ballet, and it brought back a lot of feelings, a lot of memories, and I just felt compelled to write him a letter and say, Dear George, as wonderful as it is to see your ballets, it's even more wonderful to dance them. Is this impossible? And so it was probably the shortest letter I ever wrote him, and a couple days later, I had a phone call saying that from his secretary saying that Mr. Balanchine would like to see me in New York. So on my way back to Europe, we got together and talked. He opened the door. It was like old times. We hugged each other, and it was basically, well, when do we get back to work? I think we had both changed and were eager and ready to get back to work again.
Was your relationship different when you started dancing with the ballet again?
Not really. We were still comfortable in the studio together. We laughed. I had a great fun re-exploring his repertoires and his training because it was different from where I had come from in Europe. Ballet was always our real heart and soul and center of what our lives were, and it was the air we breathed and our understanding. So it was, in a way, really like coming home.
What about your husband? Did he ever come back? I know he was never hired back by the company, but did he feel comfortable coming over even to pick you up or something?
Oh, sure. He came to the ballet and was happy to see me again. It was a time when we all knew that I was meant to be here, and it was great to be back.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with ballerina Suzanne Farrell, who's written a memoir called Holding On to the Air. You write that when Balanchine died, you wondered if you wanted to dance anymore?
Well, I knew I would not be understood in the same way that Balanchine understood me. And so much of our life was together. And when he died, well, I never thought he would die. I believed in him so much. He used to say he's Georgian from the Georgian part of Russia, Tbilisi. He said, we live forever. We live to be 100. And he was right in so many other situations, so I thought he would live to be 100. So I was totally unprepared when his health got so bad and it became clear that he was not going to get better. I missed him greatly when he died. I still miss him. And one of the reasons why I wanted to write the book was because I missed him. It was a way of holding on to him and keeping my sanity. And a lot had been written about us, and I wanted to set the record straight. On the other hand, if I were to run into him on the street now, it would be very normal. I still feel his presence so much. And so I do have him in my life all the time, every time I stage ballets. Even in my normal life, he's taught me so much.
You retired from dancing in 1989. How does it feel to not be performing?
I love to dance, and I think maybe one of my problems is that I never got bored with my work. Actually, that's not a problem, it's a privilege, but it did leave me wondering, since my hip operation, what it would be like to live without dancing in my life, and also without music. Music is the main thrust of why I love to dance, and I knew that I would not be able to dance again, but I didn't know if I'd be able to listen to music and not be able to want to dance again. So I started staging ballets, and I went to Leningrad and did Scotch Symphony for the Kirov dancers. And it was an acid test for me because I wasn't quite sure that I would be able to be open with everything I had learned, whether I would wish I were up there dancing, whether I would be able to teach them and get from them what they were meant to give and not impose myself so much. I think it's hard to make the transition, but finally, in the end, I was so fulfilled teaching the ballet to someone. And I guess the tendency often is to pick someone to do your part that looks like you, that you feel you have an affinity for, or you see yourself in. And I was happy that I didn't do that. It was a smaller dancer, and different kind of legs, different physique. But she was wonderful, and she wanted to be there. And I was happy that I could tell her everything I know, and we could go on. And I wasn't missing not being on stage, and I felt equally as exhausted or fulfilled sitting in the audience watching them. And knowing that they put their trust in what I said and I put my trust in them, it was really wonderful.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And my guest has been Suzanne Farrell. Her new autobiography is called Holding On to the Air. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, I get to ask Tennessee Ernie Ford about a record that used to scare me when I was 4 years old. 16 Tons has just been reissued by Rhino Records, and hey, I'm not afraid anymore. Also, rock historian Ed Ward tells us about some close harmony groups that predated the Everly Brothers. And Sharon Olds reads a poem. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. By a vote of 14-1, the UN Security Council has decided to impose an air embargo against Iraq, cutting off flights to and from that country and occupied Kuwait. Cuba cast the lone dissenting vote. The resolution also calls on all member nations of the UN to deny landing rights to planes coming from Iraq or Kuwait, which was invaded last month by Iraqi forces. On Capitol Hill, lawmakers questioned today whether the State Department should have done more on behalf of Americans trapped in Kuwait at the time of the Iraqi invasion. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Michael Saba is an American businessman who was planning a trip to Baghdad when he heard radio reports on the increasing buildup of Iraqi troops on Kuwait's border. He told members of a House Foreign Affairs subcommittee today that he called the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad asking whether it was safe to enter the country. Saba says their message was not to worry.
Come on up. There's no reason why Americans shouldn't be there. This was 2 days before the invasion.
Saba was able to escape from Baghdad by taking a taxi to Jordan. Several lawmakers criticized the State Department for failing to warn Americans already in Kuwait and Iraq of a possible invasion and for not issuing an updated travel advisory. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
Speaking at the UN today, Soviet Foreign Minister Shevardnadze said that war in the Middle East could break out any day because of the Iraqi invasion. The Soviet official called on Iraq to obey the demands of the law and common sense and pull its forces out of Kuwait. The Soviet foreign minister repeated a Soviet proposal that the UN Security Council's Military Staff Committee be revived to oversee a UN military force which could be used in a crisis. In Washington, South African President F.W. de Klerk wound up his visit, meeting with key members of the U.S. House and Senate and addressing the National Press Club. He flies back to South Africa tonight. NPR's Ted Clark has more.
President de Klerk returns to South Africa with a vote of confidence from President Bush, who said yesterday South African reforms are indeed irreversible. Analysts say the use of this phrase signals Mr. Bush's willingness to ask Congress to ease sanctions as soon as South Africa meets the remaining requirements of the Anti-Apartheid Act. Today at the press club, President de Klerk thanked Mr. Bush for his comment.
This will serve to us as encouragement to proceed along the road which we have taken.
But Patrick Lakota, a senior official of the African National Congress, voiced concern today about President Bush's support for de Klerk.
It will tend to encourage the government to drag its feet even more.
And many members of Congress remain unconvinced that South Africa's reforms are indeed irreversible. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 32.5 points in moderate trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Later in the show, 16 Tons. But first, the best tunes, says rock and roll historian Ed Ward, come with family harmony. Brother teams like the Everlys were able to produce some of the sweetest country music he's ever heard.
Dream.
When I first heard the Everly Brothers, I was certain that now I knew what the angels in heaven would sound like. It was almost like one body had two heads. Their singing was that close and intuitive. I really couldn't get enough of it. What I didn't realize, though, was that the Everlys hadn't invented singing like that. Probably the first important brother group to emerge in country music was the Bolick Brothers, Bill and Earl, who walked in off the streets one day in 1936 and got an RCA recording contract. And no wonder.
I'm not in your town to stay, said a lady old and gray to a warden in a penitentiary. I'm not in your town to stay, and I'll soon be on my way. I'm just here to get my baby out of jail. Oh, warden, I'm just here to get my baby out of jail.
Their mixture of sweet harmonies and sentimental new and traditional songs was just what America was looking for in the height of the Depression, and they sold countless records right up until the early 50s. In 1947, they recorded their all-time classic, Kentucky.
Kentucky, you are the dearest land outside of heaven to me. Kentucky, your laurel and your redbud tree.
We'll be hearing that song again. The Bollocks' first big competition came from Alton and Raybon Delmore, who'd probably be household words today if Alton hadn't died of lung cancer in 1951.
Hard enough, Papa can't stand his ground. He was a good father, but he's done gone down. Lord, Lord, he got them browns fairly blue. Hard enough, Papa, standing in the rain at the wire was corn. He couldn't buy grain. Lord, Lord, he got them browns fairly blue.
Play a thing, boy.
The Delmore brothers could sing, but they also rocked, as songs like Freight Train Boogie, Pan American Boogie, and Brown's Ferry Blues showed. Their guitar work was amazing and drew other virtuosos. You can still find gospel 45s by the Brown's Ferry Four, which was the Delmores and Merle Travis and others. And if you play guitar, you ought to check them out. Of course, the Delmores also sang slow numbers like this, their biggest hit.
Stay away.
The gap the Delmore brothers left was quickly filled by Ira and Charlie Louvin, two very religious young men from Alabama who always acknowledged their debt to the Delmores and who could knock out a great tune just like them.
Love thy neighbor as thyself. Do unto him as you have him do to you. Give him things that you can do without to help him live. Love thy neighbor as thyself and he will love you too.
Now this old world could be a lonesome place without a friend. We need each other every day. Together we can win. There's a little good in every man, though countless be his faults. And a word of kindness you might speak could change his inward thoughts.
Love thy neighbor as thyself. Do unto him.
But the Louvin brothers also came up during the time when Nashville was establishing itself, and they had the advantage of top-notch studios, the A-team of Nashville studio musicians, and the best songwriters in town.
You're running wild.
Louvin brothers ruled the country charts in the 50s, and certainly, as you can hear, set the stage for the Everly brothers to emerge. Like the Everly brothers, too, the Louvins eventually got to the point where they couldn't stand being around each other, and in 1963, Ira and Charlie dissolved the partnership. 2 years later, Ira was killed in an automobile accident, ending rumors of a reunion. The Everlys knew they had big shoes to step into, and it might have been more daunting if they didn't already know they had the talent. They also had the manners to thank the men who put them where they were and recorded I'm Here to Get My Baby Out of Jail and this.
Kentucky,
You hardly ever hear sounds like this anymore, even in country music. As far as I'm concerned, that's a real shame.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle, and he's co-author of the Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. This is Fresh Air. For 7 weeks in 1955, the number one record was 16 Tons, sung by Tennessee Ernie Ford. It was the fastest-selling single of its time, selling more than 1 million copies in 3 weeks. The song was written in 1947 by Merle Travis. Tennessee Ernie Ford was a popular host of a daytime variety TV show when 16 Tons hit the charts. 10 months later, he was hosting a primetime network show that lasted for 5 years. But in the late 40s and early 50s, Ford was known as a country singer. Rhino Records has just put out a new collection of his recordings. It includes his hits 16 Tons and Mule Train, as well as his early boogie-woogie tunes like this one, his own Shotgun Buggy.
Dad stands in the corner with the barrel so straight. I look out the window and over the gate. The big fat rabbits are jumping in the grass. Wait till they hear my old shotgun blast. Shotgun boogie, I done saw your track. Look out, Mr. Rabbit, when I cock my hammer back.
How did you start combining country singing with a boogie-woogie accompaniment?
Well, I wrote most of those old boogie things I did. I wrote them myself. And I got together with the musicians, and I said, why don't we put a boogie rhythm to this, which is just the old doon-da-doon-da-doon-da-doon-da-doon-da-doon-da-doon-da-doon. And it's just a country thing back in those days that was just a revitalization, I think, of the old country rhythms that we'd already had, and somebody named it Boogie Woogie, and I don't know who did that.
And one of the songs that's included on this new anthology is 16 Tons. Now, this is not a Boogie Woogie, but it's probably your best-known recording.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Every recording artist likes to have a song that identifies him with the rest of his life. Bing Crosby and I were playing golf together one time, and he said, you know, a great identity. He said, even though I'm working somewhere in the middle of July, I can't leave the stage until I sing White Christmas. And, of course, that identity that stays with you the rest of your life is a dream of all recording artists, and 16 Tons did that for me.
Some people say a man is made out of mud. A poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood and skin and bones. A mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. I was born one morning when the sun didn't shine.
I was 4 years old when 16 Tons came out. And
I was a little older now.
Yeah, I know. Now, I really loved the song when I was 4 years old, but I have to tell you, it terrified me. I found it a really scary song. First of all, you had this like really deep voice. The song was in this minor key that was very dark to me. And you were growing another day older and deeper in debt, and you know, St. Peter, don't you call me, because I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. I knew the song was about death, but I didn't know who St. Peter was. I was Jewish. I didn't know what a company store was. I was growing up in Brooklyn, New York.
The song really is a documentary lyric. My father and my uncle and the man who wrote the song, his people worked in the coal mines in Kentucky. And the average man in those days could dig 16 tons of coal in a day's work.
Is it right that you wanted to be an opera singer before you started singing country
music?
Oh,
my mother, you know, when I grew up and sang in church and so forth, she had frankly, Terry, I wanted to be a farmer. But I was a radio announcer right after I got out of high school. And was very excited about that because that was a long time ago. It was in the late 30s. And our hometown got a radio station. And I started just being a regular, what they called a staff announcer. There was no such thing as a disc jockey. So you had a regular eight-hour shift that you did everything that came on from Baptist preachers to classical music to country music to whatever was on the schedule.
Was it radio that led you into singing?
Well, somebody heard me sing. There used to be a live country show on a station in Pasadena that I worked, Cliffy Stone's Hometown Jamboree. And I used to run out of the announcer's booth and run in there and sing with them just for fun. Really, it was fun. And actually, Merle Travis was a member of that group.
Huh.
And Cliffy Stone headed it. And I would sing. And finally, Cliffy, who was a very influential, he said, well, how would you like to take a run at this thing? I said, look, you're very kind and all that, but I said, I'm a depression baby and I've got a good job. And I'm making close to $85 a week, and don't fool around. But he said, listen, I think I can get you a record contract. I said, well, I'll go ahead and go down and try out something if you want to. So that was December 1949, if I go back right. And then I did turn pro in 1950. But I still had my radio job.
Oh, you still were announcing?
Oh, sure. Uh-huh. I held on to that for a long time.
Your evening TV show was sponsored by Ford.
Right.
Did the Ford Motor Company want to sponsor your show because your name was the same? Did that have anything to do with
no,
it?
No, J. Walter Thompson Advertising Agency, after the success of my daytime show, Mr. Danny Seymour took a brochure of me back to the board of directors of Ford Motor Company called Ford. Did not have anything on nighttime television at all. And so Danny took my success story of the daytime show back there and met, and Henry II was at the meeting. And his only comment was, Ernie, who? Like this was some kind of a joke. He said, no, his name is Ford, but that didn't really make that much. He liked my work, and so we signed, and I want to meet the people in a sponsor like that. So I went back to Detroit, and I met the workers. I went to the plants. I went to the test track. I drove the cars. I met the engineers. You want to know about something like that because I always like to do one or two of the commercials when I'm on my own show. I love to sell. I love to sell as much as I like to sing. And I would do one of the commercials on the show each night, each Thursday night. And Dinah Shore and I used to joke so much about we could never be a guest on each other's show because she was on for Chevrolet.
That's right.
And she was a Tennessee girl also, you know.
Right, her theme was See the USA in a Chevrolet. Or was that
sure.
Bob Hope's theme? No. Yeah, that was her theme. Or was that Bob Hope's
theme?
That
was her, See the USA. And mm-hmm. ours was, you're ahead in the Ford all the way, yeah.
Right. What did you do after the show went off the air, the national show?
I did it 5 years, and then I was never canceled. I thought after 5 years, I wanted to, my life was, my two sons were starting to grow up a little bit, and I wanted to be with them. And so after 5 years, I terminated it myself. Even though our fifth year was our highest rated year. But I felt that I did the right thing by just taking a little sabbatical to get a hold of myself. Things were going a little bit fast for this old country boy, and I loved everything I was doing. And what I didn't want to happen was to do something to such a point that I would learn to hate it, that to have it consume me rather than to keep it and always have it there and know that whenever I do walk out, somebody will want to see me instead of saying, oh, here comes him again. And I felt that I was being consumed by it, and I wanted to take a rest I built a home and took a 9 months off, and then I took another daytime show. And so if I look back, I wouldn't change a thing.
Are you still performing now?
Oh, yes. I still do concerts. I do television specials and guest shots, and I work a lot of charity things. And I'm doing a concert in Buffalo, New York in December. And so I still work some.
Are you doing a lot of gospel music as well as country music
now?
Oh,
sure. That's a great part of our gospel. I've worked every big room in Nevada and Las Vegas and Reno and Lake Tahoe. The first thing they asked me is, you're going to close with the gospel, aren't you? And I said, well, if you want it, we got it. And, oh, yeah, it's still a part of our music. You don't have to put on a black robe and sit in a pile of ashes to sing that stuff. It's great music. Come on, it's a great music, and it's happy music. And we found that to be true when we pioneered it. And and I'm still glad, because now it's definitely a part.
Thanks. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Terry, it's been a pleasure. Come to California sometime. We'll show you around.
Tennessee Ernie Ford spoke with us from station KQED in San Francisco. 16 Tons of Boogie, the best of Tennessee Ernie Ford, is on Rhino Records.
Were you there when they crucified my Lord?
Were you there?
Were you there when they crucified my Lord? Sometimes it causes me to tremble, 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 tremble.
This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. Today we'll be hearing from NPR's Celeste Wesson about the war against drugs in public housing projects around the country. You know, one of the tactics of the government has been to evict drug dealers from public housing. Some people say that many innocent residents of public housing have been victimized along with the dealers. Hear about that. Also about the visit to Washington of the president of Turkey. Turkey, which borders on Iraq, has been a very enthusiastic supporter of sanctions against Iraq and is one of the countries hardest hit economically by those sanctions. Today, the president promised improvements in trade with Turkey and also more aid.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Sharon Olds is with us to read a poem. Writer David Levitt once described Sharon Olds as enormously self-aware. He said, her poetry is remarkable for its candor, its eroticism, and its power to move.
The poem I'm going to read is called The Bed. When I looked at it today on my way here, I thought, I wonder how many people think of poems as places where stories are told. The Bed. My father's new wife was standing at the sink in their new apartment, her hands in the suds. She was looking out the window, down at the street. She saw a tall, dark-haired teenager turn the corner. That's his girl, she said to herself. She had never seen me, not even a picture. I hadn't called. She looked at me and knew me. In a minute, the bell rang, and there I stood on his long legs, under the shock of his dark hair. She let me in, fed me something. I stared at her. This was the woman my father loved. My father was in love. I ate and ate and gazed, till we heard his key in the lock. Surprise, surprise. He saw us standing together, flushed, blushing. In the heat of that moment, softened metals, we were joined. Even 30 years later, when we stood on either side of his bed, holding his hands, and he sank away out of the human, the bond did not break. We held to him the way you hold the last child and crack the whip, so he flies, feet off the ground, and the chain holds. That first day, we stood there, cheeks hot. Then my father led us over to a wall with a groove in it, like the outline of a doorway, a passage into some other world. He pushed a button, and down out of the wall fell a double bed. Its legs bounced on the floor. It danced while he laughed, their Murphy bed of love. In the night, he said, it would close suddenly, like a book slamming. They'd wake up upright, smashed against the wall, flies under the swatter. We stood and beamed at each other. After that, when I thought of them, I thought of their bed snapping shut like a mouse trap, throwing them against the wall in violent climax, something to grasp my father as hard as I'd wanted to clasp him, the two of them crushed together like flowers pressed in a book, so flat they're transparent, the stamen lolling over the pistil, the anther indented in the petal, the man and woman as God had made them, almost my parents in love.
Sharon Olds is the director of creative writing at NYU. Her latest collection of poems, The Gold Cell, is published by Knopf. Our readings and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, with production assistance from Sue Spolin and Russ Anbucci. Our technical director is Joyce Lieberman. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Barbara Ferraro and Patricia Hussey were both nuns when they criticized the church's stand on abortion. They're not nuns anymore. On the next Fresh Air, they tell us about their confrontation with the hierarchy of the Catholic Church. Also, novelist David Lodge on satirizing life in academia. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.